We'll begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week beginning Saturday, February 26th, 2005, this is the Rain Report, the weekly audio ham radio program service of Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network. FYI, if you missed James Milner, WB2REM's talk about the evolution of VOIP over amateur radio last week, it will remain online at rainreport.com until next weekend when the new Rain Report goes online. Thanks to CQ Publications for audio underwriting of our WMA broadband stream. This week we'll learn about Echolink, which some consider the most popular voice over internet VOIP program being heard over amateur radio. Its developer is Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD.
Echolink is a Microsoft Windows-based program which achieves a voice-over IP system. It works with either custom interfaces or the multi-mode interfaces which are used for other modes such as PSK31 and HF. It uses a centralized validation and security mechanism, and fortunately, it has become popular since May 15th, 2002. Well, we've added 125,000 registered users in 148 countries, and this appears to be a pretty much linear growth pattern, so that growth continues. There are currently about 5,800 active RF nodes worldwide, most of which are part-time. You'll typically see about 1,500 RF nodes online on Echolink. There are actually four different types of Echolink nodes that work in any of two different modes. There are repeater links, which are simply links to a local repeater, either with equipment at the repeater site or through a transceiver that's tuned to the repeater pair. A simplex link, which can operate on a simplex frequency. A single user, which is somebody sitting at a PC who's been validated for Echolink using the PC speaker and microphone in sort of a remote base fashion. And a conference server, which actually uses different software, a package called The Bridge, which is simply a conference server that can allow multiple stations to connect and carry on one QSL, equivalent to a reflector in the IRLP world. Typical uses of Echolink are to link distant or local repeaters together. Basically, when you have a voice over IP link between repeaters, you have effectively joined the coverage area of two repeaters. And that can either be a repeater that's 1,000 miles away, or it could be a repeater that's on the other side of the state. For example, you could imagine a link up where all the major repeaters in southern Ohio have been interconnected by a voice over IP link. And what you have in effect is a super repeater, which allows mobile stations that are in the coverage areas of any of those repeaters to communicate with each other. Tremendous public service possibilities. You can also extend the range of a repeater through a simplex link, basically having the equivalent of a remote receiver and transmitter connected to the primary repeater site through the internet. And finally, with Echolink, you can access or monitor a distant repeater using a PC. Just to diagram some of these situations, here's an example of a simplex-to-simplex link where my link in Connecticut is linked over the internet to Terry's link in Sydney, Australia. Basically, any mobile station that's in range of my simplex link can communicate with any simplex station that's in range of Terry's. It sort of forms a wormhole between the two sites. Another example is we have a repeater in Connecticut, which is has an Echolink node, and it allows remote stations to connect to it both in PC or RF fashion. In this example, we have two stations using PCs that are connected at the same time to the Echolink node in Connecticut. And finally, and this is, I think, one of the most powerful features actually of any voice over IP system, is the ability to do on-demand repeater-to-repeater links. When the need arises, you can set up a link where no link existed before. As long as all the stations involved are equipped with the correct hardware and software, you can say for the following purpose, which could be disaster communications, I want to link the following repeaters together. And this sort of ad hoc linking is one of the real powerful features of the voice over IP systems. When you're using Echolink, either in the single user mode or in the sysop mode, you do have a graphical user interface, which displays the current list of logged on stations. We have sort of an explorer type view where a list of all the various locations is shown as folders on the left, and then a list of the logged on stations in that folder is shown on the right. Behind the scenes is sort heard of a lot more than meets the eye. There's a fair amount of stuff packed into the Echolink executable. Underneath the user interface are a number of major subcomponents which deal with things like security, with the actual voice over IP transport from node to node, with dealing with things in sysop mode such as generating a Morse code ID or a sampled speech generator when it announces that a station has been connected or if it identifies itself in voice. Those are actually samples of my own voice that are used inside the program. And also some DSP functions. There's a DSP filter available to filter out PL tones. It uses a digital audio mixer to combine signals from various sources inside the program. It also has an onboard DTMF decoder, which is an option that can be used, so you can do DTMF detection in software through a DSP technique. There also is a couple of mechanisms for remote control, including an internal web server and a dial-in remote control feature.
You're listening to a 2004 Dayton Hamvention Talk by Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the mind behind Echolink, a software package that combines the best of both ham radio and the Internet. This is the RAIN Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for RAIN audio.
One of the misconceptions about Echolink is that all the communication between stations is going through a server, and this is simply not the case. The servers are used for validation, security, and for directory services, essentially, to keep track of who's online and what their status is at the current moment, and it's specifically what their IP addresses are. The system actually consists of a number of servers. There is a central validation server, which holds the database of all the Echolink users in the world, and which becomes sort of our central point of control for the system. But there's also a set of what I call regional addressing servers, which are sort of satellite servers to these. These are completely fault-tolerant, load-balanced systems. Each regional addressing server holds a cached copy of the user list and also keeps a live copy of the users that are logged in. These regional addressing servers talk to each other every 20 seconds, sending deltas of what's changed since the last time the update was sent. In that sense, all the regional addressing servers, and there are currently four of them, stay in sync, plus or minus 20 seconds. And this way we can achieve load balancing and be able to scale the system, so that if we were to double or triple or quadruple the number of users, it would simply be a matter of adding more of these regional addressing servers to support the load. Plus, if you shoot any two or three of them, the system stays up. The basic components are a computer, personal computer running any version of Windows, and the Echolink software with an internet connection through a modem. It can either be a dial-up connection or a broadband connection is preferred. A sound card interface that connects the sound card of the computer to your transceiver, and the transceiver is used as the link into the RF world. And as I mentioned before, that can either be tuned to a simplex frequency or can be tuned to the frequency pair of a local repeater. So as long as the node is within earshot of a repeater, you can have an effective link to that repeater. It's also possible, of course, to place the whole kit and caboodle at the repeater site, and that has certain advantages in some situations. You sometimes have more control over the audio paths and things like that. Interfaces for linking fall into several categories. There are the special purpose linking interfaces, which have built-in DTMF detection, which sometimes gives higher performance, sometimes have audio routing options that make it easier to connect the other equipment, and also can be used for the carrier-operated squelch interface to the receiver for more reliable detection. You can also use generic sound card interfaces, such as the types used for HF digital modes, and there are many of them available. It will work with either type. And there's also interfaces that combine the best of both worlds. An example of the sort of generic interfaces are the ones that the Rig Blaster folks produce. There's several different models which have various features. I don't sell these, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but this is one option. And also the boards that WB2RAM and G4CDY produce, which come in several varieties. HUVA3TO also makes an excellent interface board, which also has a built-in DTMF detection circuit and a little prototyping area for adding your own components. But you can also homebrew one. Myth and fact about internet linking. The first myth that I often hear is that VoIP would be completely useless in an emergency because it relies on the internet, and everybody knows the internet would go down in an emergency. Well, there's a couple of problems with that statement. First of all, the internet has actually been designed to be extremely fault tolerant. I think the U.S. Defense Department did most of the early research in the internet and have designed it to survive all kinds of natural disasters and unnatural disasters. The second issue is, if you think about it, a lot of public service communication or disaster communication that goes on is not specifically in the affected area. And I think that the way I put it here is that internet service is often still available close to a disaster area, if not immediately in it, with ham radio often providing the sort of last-mile communication in and out of the affected area. And this is an example of us using all of our skills for the best advantage. Our communication, our RF skills, our ability to deploy mobile and portable units to a disaster area, but also our ability to interconnect those systems in such a way that we can achieve better communication. And I think that Echolink and IRLP have already proven their effectiveness for disaster communications. The second myth is internet linking is all fine and good, but it's not legal. The fact is that in nearly every country, internet links are legal if they're operated in a legal manner. So it's important to understand the rules and regulations of the country in which you live and apply them to the internet node that you're setting up. The major systems do offer mechanisms to help operate the link within regulations. For example, in the U.S., the ability to use remote control over a wireline or RF control link is built into the software. The third myth, and we don't hear it quite as often as we used to, but that this is just bad for ham radio, because this is not radio. My answer to that is that internet linking promotes interest in amateur radio and extends its capabilities. It does not replace them. Integration with other communications technologies, I think, is going to be extremely important to amateur radio in the 21st century for this service, this hobby of ours, to remain vital and remain relevant. It's going to be very important for us to adopt communications technologies that can interoperate with amateur radio.
Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the man behind Echolink, a popular program that, along with IRLP, has breathed new life into amateur radio. We excerpted from Jonathan's 2004 Dayton Hamvention presentation. The Rain Report is copyright 2005 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ.